Accession number 18802, reel 15.
Brigadier Catlin, reel 15.
As I said, my instinct always, wherever we go, is to become involved with the local population. But sadly, because of, let's call it the cantonment background, on the one hand, and because we were really extraordinarily busy, just on everyday events, on the other hand, one didn't become involved as much as one would like to have done. There were one or two local people, Jennifer and I knew quite well, and, you know, we went to their house and they came to our house. The Brigadier knew one or two of the hierarchy, not well, but sufficiently well, and, you know, he tried to do his stuff. But overall, we did not succeed as much as I would like to have done.
What about relations between the brigade as a whole and the town? Were they generally good?
Yes, I would have thought so. Certainly, I don't recollect any particular problems. I mean, obviously, there were one or two cases of drunken soldiers and traffic accidents and things like that, which caused a bit of upset. But that was ironed out with the local police. Again, I knew the local policeman quite well, and that helped. But no, I mean, by and large, relations were quite good, I would have thought.
What about when you went out into the field and were exercising and manoeuvring? Did you ever do any manoeuvring and exercising over private land?
Yes. We weren't involved in what I call the clearance arrangements, because that was handled through the overall machinery. It always amazed me how readily the Germans put up with really quite considerable damage to their property during exercises. But, of course, somebody was coming along with a bag of money behindhand and settling things on the spot, more or less. So, I mean, I think Honor was satisfied, and I think on the whole, the Germans reckoned, well, it was all in a good cause, in sort of protecting them against the hordes from the east.
Did you ever have a sight of the hordes from the east while you were at Osnabrück?
No. I think I probably saw the odd Socksmith person from time to time, but no more than that.
Did they tend to come sniffing around when you were exercising?
Yes.
Did you have any means of keeping them away from things they should have been kept away from?
Certainly they were kept away. I can't remember how. I mean, they certainly didn't do us any particular harm.
Did you have any contacts with Allied forces while you were brigade major at Osnabrück?
Not as close as I would have liked. We had joint affairs with both Americans and Belgians, I remember, but not very often, and I don't recall having anything with the French.
Well, at this stage, they were becoming rather alienated from the integrated military structure.
Yes, but on the other hand, they had their own zone, let's call it, which, you know, we went to from time to time or passed through. But I certainly, at our level, don't recall any particular communication with them.
What did you make of the Belgians when you met them?
I don't think we ever discussed what you might call a formal view, but I think my own personal view would have been they were nice enough, but not. They seemed to be on a different wavelength from us.
In terms of tactics or expectations, or in what sense?
I think in terms of expectations, yes.
And how did their expectations differ from our own.
I think, although I've gone out of my way in the last reel to say that perhaps our reliance on predominantly nuclear response may have been unrealistic, I think I got an impression that the Belgians were perhaps a little bit more unrealistic than we were, but if you ask me to explain that in detail, it's just an impression. I couldn't give you chapter and verse for it. Just an impression.
Did you have any joint exercises with them?
Only once.
What happened on that? Did you manage to get along all right?
Oh, yes, we got on perfectly well, but my recollection is it was a signal exercise, and therefore, you know, not very close.
So you didn't have troops operating side by side?
No.
And what about the Americans, your impressions of them at that time?
Again, we didn't do troop exercises with them at any stage that I can recollect, and so we're talking again of signal exercises with them, very much on a flank and very much not immediately part of the system, and so one probably only met them at a wash-up or something of that sort. And so I don't think we formed a particular view, except to say that they seem to behave as Brits tend to view Americans as behaving.
Which is?
Brash, I think I would summarise it as. But nice enough and friendly enough.
Do you think they had the same sort of tactical ideas and concept of operations?
I don't know. We never discussed that, that I can remember. And their bit of country was quite different from ours. And I don't know what they were up to.
Around about this time, I think National Service was beginning to run down because the decision had been taken in 1957 to phase out National Service and to replace a National Service Army with a fully regular army. Did this cause any changes that were visible to you?
No, because it didn't really happen up to the end of my time in 12th Brigade. It happened rather more my next assignment, which was as recruiting officer for the Green Jackets across the whole country in 1961, before I went back to the Staff College. And that, of course, was the exact moment that the change was taking place. So I don't recall it having much effect in 1960.
What sort of turnover did you have in the brigade during a year when you were in 12th Brigade?
You're talking in terms of numbers of soldiers.
The soldiers, right? Yes, arriving and leaving. And
I can't answer that question. I've no idea. Absolutely no idea at all. Because that was very much a unit matter. I suppose at the time I would have been aware of it if some unit had said, you know, gracious, we're losing a huge number of people. But I don't remember that happening.
Do you recollect if drafts arrived, you know, in on a large scale at regular intervals, or if there was a sort of trickling
I don't
in
know.
And out?
Unit matter, I don't know.
What sort of things could you do in your off-duty and leisure time when you were 12th Brigade?
Well, all the usual sports, hockey, those sort of things, which I still played. I did a certain amount of rough shooting with Germans, which was one of the most dangerous things I've ever done in my life.
Why was that?
Well, because they insisted on, we were, I mean, it was walking up and we were looking for hare and perhaps the odd pheasant, but mainly hare. And they did insist on sort of surrounding these animals in a sort of circle and firing more or less indiscriminately. So it was quite dangerous.
Fully concentric gun line.
Yes. Which I'd never seen before. It wasn't quite as bad as that, but it was getting on that way.
Now, this would seem to require exceptional self-discipline and restraint.
Yes.
For safety.
It was all right, just. And, of course, fun to go out with, you know, the ordinary... They were common German farmers.
Mm.
And I didn't mention that when we were talking about local population. And it was... I mean, I don't speak the language fluently, but I can understand a lot and can just about get by to make myself understood. And it was jolly nice to go out with people like that, even although they're a bit dangerous.
When you finally came to the end, how did you organise the handover?
Well, it's an extraordinary thing. I had taken over from somebody in my own regiment, and I handed over to somebody in my own regiment. And so there, we knew each other very well, and so a lot of it was just verbal. I mean, we produced a lot of paper and things he had to read, the operational plan and things like that, which he had to read at leisure. But mainly we talked. And because we knew each other very well, we talked very frankly to each other.
What did he think of the operational plan and the operational concept? Do you recall how he reacted to it?
I think he just said, oh yes, and you know, that's it, I will become aware of it later.
Was it a detailed plan?
It was more an operational directive. Setting out the philosophy of, you know, the watch and ward and all the rest of it.
But not specifying positions or giving detailed orders to units?
It specified positions, and it specified initially who was going to fill those positions, but it didn't specify anything much beyond that, except a concept of battle.
Had you drawn that up on your own, or had you drawn that up with interventions from the brigade commander?
Oh, very much as a joint effort. Very much as a joint effort, and with the gunner brought in, the gunner CO brought in as well.
What about the unit commanders? Were they given a sight of the plan for comment before it was finally promulgated?
I can't answer that question directly, but my guess is... that it was formulated as a result of various CO's conferences.
Did you actually draw it up initially as a draft, or did you get some sort of outline idea from the brigade commander before going about writing it?
No, I did it from scratch as far as the formal document was concerned, and obviously he then approved it.
So you produced a draft?
Yes.
Which went to him and the gunner, and then comments were taken up.
Yes.
And then another draft, presumably.
No, I think we probably went to firm after that.
So one draft.
I think it was one draft,
yeah,
from memory.
And then revision, and then the op order.
Yes.
Roughly how long did that process take? You said it took 2 years to produce it, but I'm thinking in terms of actual working time spent on doing it.
Well, if you've got a handover coming, it does... focus attention.
Concentrates the mind.
It concentrates the mind on things that haven't been done. And I don't know. I mean, I really don't know exactly how long it took. But it meant a lot of jolly hard work over a concentrated period of time.
Was there anything else that you felt had to be done before you handed over?
No, everything else was up to date.
So you were happy with the rest?
Yes.
How long did the handover take, in terms of days passing?
I think we gave ourselves a week. It's very interesting, this question of handover times. I think up to and including that particular job and that particular level, I think you need a detailed handover, and it takes about a week. I think... technically, you're allowed 10 days. I think that's right, or it used to be. But then you come to other jobs, like commanding officers and brigadiers and my last job in London and so on, where really the sooner the gaffer, the current gaffer gets out of the way and lets the new gaffer get on with it, the better. And if I could take an example, it's not answering your question, but it's the thought. My last job, we had my successor and his wife to lunch in London in our house, and he and I did a couple of hours in the morning and I suppose probably 2-3 hours in the afternoon talking about the things that had to be talked about, like relations with the Foreign Office, relations with X, Y, and Z, any particular problems, people who kept on saying, you know, that you should be disbanded and have something else instead. You know, all these silly questions that, as we were discussing earlier, come up regularly with people who don't know any better. Those sort of things we dealt with. But as far as the detail of the job was concerned, I had a perfectly adequate deputy. And he was responsible for briefing the man in detail on a daily basis, plus the heads of sections, on their own specialities. Now, I believe that at certain jobs and certain levels, that is the right way to handle it, and that you don't want a long handover between two gaffers. And indeed, I did the same thing with the brigade commander in Northern Ireland when I left there. And I that's just my personal view on how handover should be done.
To summarise that, would it be right to say that you think that at chief of staff level, at the sort of executive officer level, it's necessary for there to be a detailed handover, but at the command level, it isn't, because the new commander can expect to be briefed by his brigade major or adjutant or his, you know, his number two, his chief of staff.
Yes, broadly speaking, I think that's true. Whether you can apply the same thought to chiefs of staff at all levels, I'm not sure. I mean, what the chief of staff at theatre level would say, I don't know. I suspect he would say, get out of it quick and leave the new man to be briefed by the various
heads of departments
and make the thing work. I would guess, but I really don't know. But the level I have worked at, I thought a full period of about a week was right at the brigade major level, but I don't think it's right at brigade commander level and various other jobs I've done.
When your new brigadier arrived, Pat Mann, was there a long or short takeover for him? And what was your role in that?
I don't remember. I suspect there wasn't a long period of handover. I just don't remember. I mean, Jimmy Dixon went and Pat Mann arrived. I did an enormous amount alongside him in his opening days, talking about this and that. And obviously he talked to all the commanding officers and so on. And established very early on his wishes for the way the brigade should be run.
How much advance warning did you have of your next job then, the job of brigade recruiting officer?
It had been discussed for a little while. I think it all depended on when I was going to go back to Camberley. And eventually it was decided that that would be in December 1961, sorry, November 1961, for the last term of the outgoing course, and then I would take on immediately for the 1962 intake. And so I had a period to fill, which, you know, some people went on gardening leave, but the Green Jackets needed a recruiting officer, and I was delighted to do the job. It was completely different from anything I'd ever done before.
What were the main requirements of the new job, a brigade recruiting officer? What were the issues you had to handle?
As you mentioned just now, the change from a National Service Army to an all-regular army, point one. Point two, to establish that the Green Jackets had the right to recruit throughout the United Kingdom, rather than just in London and Winchester. I did a sum at one stage. I think there were 107 recruiting offices round about the country, and I think I went to about 90 of them. I mean, I did a lot of travelling, and we had to organise a sort of our own little demonstration lot. We used the demonstration battalion at Warminster to do demonstration drills and things. And one of the things that always was very popular with crowds was arms drill without any words of command, and indeed marching drill without words of command. We needed bands, we needed buglers, we needed to put ourselves on the map.
Advertising.
And more than advertising, too. Presence, very important. And I can remember one of the things we did. I mean, I'm jumping about in terms of months and so on, but one of the big things we did was the John Lewis lot have a store in Birmingham and a store in Liverpool. And we had a major show in Liverpool, which Bessie Braddock came to open. And, you know, that put us absolutely on the spot throughout Merseyside.
How did you persuade Bessie to assist you?
I absolutely can't remember, but it was done. I think it was arranged locally. It wasn't certainly arranged by me specifically.
This is going beyond advertising and into public relations.
Oh, very much so. In fact, I was hesitating when you used the word advertising just now, and I think I responded by saying it was more than advertising. It's presence on the ground, it's personal behaviour, personal example, organisation, all these things. And if you put it into PR, yes, you wouldn't be far out. But it's certainly much more than advertising. I mean, advertising was a part of it.
Was the regiment concerned that it might not be able to get sufficient recruits when the regular system came in, or was it confident that it would be able to do so?
Well, first of all, it wasn't a regiment then, it was a brigade.
Yes.
It was the Green Jacket Brigade, made up of the 1st Battalion of the Oxenbucks, the 60th, and the Rifle Brigade. And they didn't, in fact, become the Royal Green Jackets until 1964, when they were 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Battalions Royal Green Jackets. And so we're dealing with three separate regiments. And it so happened that it was the Oxenbucks who were the demonstration battalion at Warminster. And so they were the ones who appeared more than everybody else did, although there were recruiting sergeants scattered around the United Kingdom. Some of them were full-scale army recruiters. There weren't many of those. They were mostly special recruiters, as they were called. And we inserted a sergeant wherever we could, wherever they were acceptable. And I think we had about 7 of them in the end, maybe even 9, scattered around the countryside. And we had certainly had one in Liverpool. We had one in Birmingham, we had one in Sunderland, and doing the northeast, and we had 2 or 3 in London, our traditional recruiting area. And to be honest, I can't remember where else. I think there was one in Slough for some reason or other.
That used to be Buckinghamshire, didn't it, Slough?
Yes, yes, of course, yes.
And were the regiments confident then, or was the brigade confident that you would be able to get the ranks filled up, or did you think there might be problems with
attraction? I think we
attraction?
None of us knew, because, well, you see, as an individual lot, we were confident that we were a very good lot. We were confident that our name was good. We were confident that we could produce people who would impress round about the countryside and who would be resolute and would do their job properly. But I don't think any of us knew what the result would be. All we knew was we got to work jolly hard to get people into us as opposed to into some other lot.
So you felt you were in competition with the rest of the army?
Very much so. Very much so. And not only with the rest of the infantry, the rest of the army.
Did you view any other regiments in particular as being strong competitors who had to be looked out for?
No. Don't think so. Because I think we thought we were better than most.
So you were just up against the whole of the rest of the army in its various categories?
We were up against the young men, really. We were up against the whole of the rest of the army in numbers terms. Mm. And in terms of people you were going to get, we were up against young men who probably didn't want to go into the army initially, or young men who did want to go in the army, in which case you had to convince them you were the right people to come into it. And we ran some very good, although I say it myself, weekends at Winchester, at the depot as it then was, for these young men. And there was a particularly good training company commander who went out of his way to help on the recruiting side, went out of his way to look after these young men when they came for these weekend visits. And having acquired whoever we acquired, when they got to training camp, he went out of his way to look after them properly, even to the extent, if somebody went absent, overstayed a weekend leave or something, even to the extent that he and a sergeant major went off and ambushed them somewhere and brought them back before there was too much trouble. I mean, he was a great caring officer.
That's almost babysitting, isn't it?
Yeah, but yes, it's almost babysitting on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's perhaps teaching young men to take responsibility as well.
Did you have a particular type of young man you were trying to attract? Because on the one hand, you obviously wanted them to, you know, fill up the ranks of the numbers, but on the other hand, you would want to, presumably, want to attract
quality.
Young men with certain qualities.
Quality. We were looking for young men of initiative. We were looking for young men, really, you see, if you look at the background to the Green Jackets as a whole, and the Rifle Brigade in particular, and the 60th, rather more than the Ochsenbachs, although they're similar. We had been brought up, from the moment we joined, to believe in self-discipline on the one hand, initiative and people thinking for themselves on the other hand, and people operating as individuals, even when cut off, on the third hand. All those things are sort of built into one. And those were the sort of young men we were looking for, who would respond to that sort of training. I'm not sure that answers your question, but it's the best I can do.
Just wondering how you could actually tailor your public relations and other measures to attract the right sort of man.
I don't think you could. I think initially you were getting them interested in the concept of a green uniform, is really what I suppose one's saying, because the green men turned up at these various exhibitions and things that we did. And one was in the hands of these recruiting sergeants I've talked about, the special recruiters, for doing a certain amount of selection themselves and weeding out those who they knew were unsuitable. Mm. One relied on the individual recruiting offices and the permanent staff of those offices to reject people who were unsuitable, medically or otherwise. And so quite a lot of refining went on before they ever got to us. We then looked at these weekends, and anybody who expressed an interest from those weekends was sent off to a recruiting office. So again, they went through the weeding process. But even so, a number of people arrived for training who were unsuitable. And, you know, I'm afraid one either made them better or one rejected them.